want to thank everyone for inviting me here to speak in New Hampshire. It's great to be back in New England. But I must say, you know, it's a little strange to be sitting in New England talking about the death penalty, because, you know, the world is moving away from the death penalty. Some 70% of all the countries on this planet have now abolished it, either in fact or in practice. And in 2008, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Pakistan, and the United States accounted for 95% of all the executions. Thanks. And even in the United States, much of the country has rejected the death penalty. As you probably know, 15 states now no longer have the death penalty on the books. Moreover, two-thirds of all United States counties have never returned a death sentence. And 3% of the counties in the United States have accounted for 50% of the death sentence. The death penalty is primarily a Southern institution. Since 1977, when the modern death penalty era began, the Southern states have accounted for over 80% of all the executions. Texas has alone accounted for 40% of them. And yet even much of Texas is not that bloodthirsty, because over 33% of the death sentences in Texas have come from one place, Houston. If Houston were a state, it would rank second to Texas in the United States, given the number of executions since 1977. So we're talking about very isolated pockets of the United States that practice capital punishment. The vast majority of the United States, like the vast majority of the world, have rejected capital punishment. So where does that leave us? I'd like to address two issues today. I'd like to talk about whether capital punishment can be justified in the abstract. This is a moral and political theory question. And then I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the reality of the death penalty. Because even if one accepts that the death penalty is morally or acceptable, the question is, how does it work? And is it fair? A growing number of Americans and people around the world, even if they think that the death penalty is morally justifiable, have decided it just simply doesn't work. It's a broken system. So, but I don't want to give up the moral argument. I think too often we give up this argument, and I think we have a very powerful argument that the death penalty is not morally acceptable. The first question we have to ask is, would we be less safe if we abolished the death penalty? Because if we would be less safe, then I think you have a good moral argument that we need the death penalty. But the answer is that clearly we would not be less safe. There is no credible evidence that demonstrates that the death penalty is a deterrent. There is, however, some evidence that the death penalty actually promotes violence, because it reflects an attitude that in some cases, death can be deserved. And I like to say that the places where the death penalty has been abolished do not have higher homicide rates. Their prisons are no more violent or dangerous than the prisons in states where the death penalty exists. There's been a recent published study that surveyed the top criminologists in the United States. 88% of them said that they do not believe the death penalty is a deterrent. And most, even more importantly, 77% said that debates about the death penalty distract Congress and state legislatures from focusing on real solutions to our crime problems. There was another study that surveyed police chiefs, and a majority of them also said that they do not believe that the death penalty is an effective law enforcement tool. So that's one issue, and that is whether the death penalty makes us more safe. It does not. Another question is, do we need the death penalty for retribution? Now again, the places where the places that don't have the death penalty, the people there have not responded by rioting or other acts of private vengeance. The survivors of homicide, victims have not found it more difficult to heal. In fact, there is anecdotal evidence that the death penalty is deleterious to the healing of the survivors, because the death penalty, the 10 or 12 years it takes to execute someone, simply prolongs the suffering. The people in the places that have abolished the death penalty have decided that life imprisonment constitutes sufficient retribution. They have decided that life imprisonment accords profound respect to homicide victims and survivors, that it protects society as much as the death penalty because the offender is securely in our custody and under our control, and it respects the dignity of human life and allows offenders a chance at redemption or reformation. Now, to turn the question around, would the world be a better place if we abolished the death penalty? I submit that it would. Most of the current affronts by the government to basic human dignity have been driven by a particular immoral perspective, and that is that there are some individuals who are less than human and undeserving of human rights. And we've seen that in their renditions and the secret prisons and the torture by our government and Abu Ghraib, and then how the people in my former city of New Orleans were treated after Katrina. Now, those of us in the death penalty community have long dealt with that moral perspective. There is no greater abuse of government power than to destroy the lives of arbitrarily chosen individuals. And invariably, the death penalty is reserved for the poor, the isolated, the powerless, the different, and the other. The death penalty is a poor man's penalty. Make no mistake about that. New Hampshire, it's the only thing I'm going to say about New Hampshire. You've had a little recent experience with that in your two most recent death penalty cases. The white millionaire got life. The black poor man got death. Okay, there are no millionaires on death row, and there are very few people from the middle class. And in fact, to look at it from another angle, the Nebraska legislature commissioned a study which found that you are four times more likely to get the death penalty if you kill a well-to-do person than if you kill a poor person or middle-class person. So we see extraordinary economic status bias in the death penalty. Now, it is precisely because the death penalty is reserved for the different that a majority continues to support it. But we know that majorities united by passion must not be permitted, and I'm quoting, unjust violations of the rights and interests of the minority or of individuals. And I was not quoting an ACLU paper, I was quoting James Madison as to why we need a Bill of Rights, why we needed a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is often the lonely individual's only protection against the fierce power of government. And we, in the death penalty, we are dealing with the fierce power of the government. Now, in addressing the morality, we should also look to organized religions. The vast majority of organized religions oppose capital punishment. They do so in part because capital punishment is incapable of showing mercy and denies the humanity of the condemned and the possibility of their reformation. It simply denies their humanity and says they are incapable of reformation or redemption. The world's religions also recognize that the death penalty sends the wrong message. Instead of teaching respect for the dignity of life, it instructs that cool, deliberate, and lethal violence can be justified even when not used in self-defense. Now, I've personally spoken to over 100 defendants who were either charged with capital cases or have received the death penalty. And I can tell you, every one of them had some good in them. Many of them were also highly remorseful for their crimes. Now, this might be many years later, but they were remorseful, and many of them had reached some level of redemption. And they have thought hard about it. I can tell you a few stories that might illustrate this. That I represented a guy in Mississippi who was charged with killing a woman at an ATM machine. He was a member of a gang, and every time he went to court, the newspaper would describe him as remorseless, which not showing any emotion. And, you know, that's the opinion that everyone in the community had, that this person had no feelings at all. He didn't care. Okay. And so I managed to work out a plea for him, and it was difficult because the victim was a woman with three young children, and her husband was very vocal. And well, right before we were going for the plea, I said with him, he was 17 years old, and at that time, of course, you could get the death penalty when you were 17. That's no longer the case. And I went back to see him in a room to talk to him about what was going to occur in court, and he grabbed my hand and held my hand. He was so afraid. And we went out into the courtroom, and the victim's husband was allowed to talk, and he came up in front of us, and he started to scream at the kid, and then he threw the pictures of the three children at him and said, "I want you to just look at these pictures all the time during your time in prison, and think about how you deprived these kids of their mother." And we went back into the holding cell with him after the plea, and my co-counsel said, "You don't have to keep those pictures if you don't want." And he said, "Oh, but I do." And then afterwards, I met the husband outside. He said, "What did he do with those pictures?" And I said, "He kept them." Another case I want to tell you about is a client I represented who killed two young children, killed one young child with a shotgun, 4-year-old girl, and seriously injured a 3-year-old boy. And it was, you know, obviously a very high-profile case. And if you just based your assessment of what should happen to this guy based on that fact, people would think, what an awful crime he deserved. If the death penalty should be for anyone, it should be for someone like that, right? Well, what happened, he was an engineering student at 18 or 19. And at 18 years old. And then at 19, as many schizophrenics do, he started to develop schizophrenia. And he became very paranoid. And he was medicated. And he left school and he got a little job. He couldn't really work anymore. He was too disabled by it. But he would take his medication. But they started to have bad side effects. And so he would, every once in a while, he'd go off his medication. And right before this offense, or some period of time before this offense, he finally told his sister, "We have to go get some medication." And they were driving to get it, and just at the last minute, he said, "You know, I don't want the medication. I can't stand the side effects." And he went back, and he kept having these delusions that people were forcing him to take drugs. And that was his delusion. And when he fired the rifle that day, he thought he was shooting at these forces that were going to get him to take drugs. That's what was going through his mind. Now, this was in Louisiana, this case, and at that time, if you were found insane, you went to a state hospital for the rest of your life. And the state hospital was as bad as a prison. So they offered us life in this case because they recognized the mental illness, and we decided to take it. To this day, I've always, you know, had some regrets about that, particularly since the Supreme Court subsequently ruled that it was unconstitutional to keep people who were found not guilty by reason of insanity in a state hospital for their whole lives. But in any event, he was taking his medication at this point. He took the deal. And I remember the day we took the deal, he got all dressed up, and he cleaned his hair, and I looked down at he shined his shoes. He was just trying to make a good appearance in court. And he was so upset by what he had done. And I just remember looking down and seeing a little water on his shoe, his shiny shoe, and thinking how sad this was. So what I want to tell you is that virtually every one of the people on death row were victims of serious childhood maltreatment, severe mental trauma, childhood trauma, mental illness, brain damage, and similar factors. And so there's humanity there. And so I don't think, as a moral matter, we can justify the death penalty. I'd like to talk to you a little bit from another perspective, and that is from a political theory perspective. Is the death penalty acceptable as a matter of political theory? And I would suggest it's not. And the reason is because under a system of limited government, the government should always use the most restrictive means to achieving its interests. And why is that so? It's so because we've learned that we have to be deeply suspicious of the government when it seeks to act in ways that interfere with basic fundamental rights and with the lives of discrete and powerless minorities. As the great Supreme Court Justice William Brennan said, the Constitution declares that the majoritarian chorus may not alone dictate the conditions of social life. Now, the principle of limited government is highly relevant to the capital punishment discussion. Surely, given the scorn with which courts and majorities treat capital defendants, and that's true even before they've been convicted, we have no reason to trust that the government will create a fair and equitable and error-free system of determining who will live and who will die, unless it has to execute that person, again, to protect itself. Now, as I've already told you, we don't need the death penalty to protect ourselves. Pope John Paul eventually reached that conclusion in 1995 in his Evangelium Vitae, and this is what he said. Execution is appropriate only in cases of absolute necessity. In other words, when it would not be possible otherwise to defend society. Today, however, as a result of steady improvement in the organization of the penal system, such cases are very rare, if not practically non-existent. Certainly in the United States, we have no need for the death penalty. So simply put, from a moral perspective, but from a political theory perspective, the government should simply not be in the business of deciding who will live and who will die. A clearly guilty guy. We know he's guilty, and he wasn't mentally ill, and we know he's a monster. This guy is just a monster, and he did this awful thing, and he definitely did it, and so that we need the death penalty for that case. But I would submit to you three things. Number one, if we've learned anything, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about innocence in a second, but if we've learned anything in the recent years with the explosion of exonerations from death row, it is that we do not have any accurate way of determining who is clearly guilty. We simply don't know. Number two, no one is clearly monstrous. No one is incapable of reformation. And three, even if there are people who are monstrous and incapable of reformation, we have no way of accurately determining who they are. So in short, I don't think the death penalty can be justified as a moral proposition. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about the death penalty, of the reality of the death penalty, not from an abstract proposition, but the reality, really what's going on in the United States today with the death penalty. Okay? And the fact is that the death penalty is a deeply flawed institution that is unworthy of a society that purports to cherish justice. Okay? The big thing, of course, with the death penalty is that it is fraught with error. Since 1973, 138 innocent defendants have been exonerated from death row, and over 60% of them were persons of color. Okay? In addition, 10 men have been executed, even though there were serious questions about their guilt. Now, people often respond to those arguments by saying, well, today we have DNA evidence, so we can figure out who did it. Those are cases from years ago, and DNA solved all those cases. That's why we have all these innocents. Well, there's two responses to that. The first is that DNA evidence only exists in 10% of murder cases. It doesn't exist. There's no DNA to test in 90% of murder cases. Because either the only way to test DNA is if the victim left DNA on the perpetrator or the perpetrator left DNA at the scene. Now, in rape cases, the percentage is a lot higher. But in murder cases, it's only 10%. And that's not me saying it. It's Michael Badden, the former pathologist of New York, in New York, who's one of the world's foremost criminologists and forensic pathologists. The other thing I would say about this DNA thing, and what people don't realize, is that these 138 exonerees, only I think 15% of them were exonerated through DNA. Really, what happened in these cases is we found, these cases have demonstrated just these serious flaws in our criminal justice system. Okay? Faulty eyewitness identifications, faulty forensic sciences, use of jailhouse snitches who lied, false confessions, things of that sort. Now, I do want to make a point because some people respond to this by saying, look, you just want the system to be perfect. No system can be perfect. These problems exist in non-death penalty cases too. What are we going to do? Just not prosecute crimes? Well, I think that asks the wrong question. Because if you take away the death penalty, in a regular criminal case, we do the best we can. We're going to make errors, but we're not extinguishing a human life. Okay, that's number one. And number two, what is the alternative to not prosecuting someone? The alternative is not prosecuting crime. And I think that's probably, for most people, an entirely unacceptable alternative, not to prosecute any crimes. But what's the alternative to the death penalty? It's not to prosecute the crime. It's simply life in prison. That's the alternative. That's why it's not the same. And another thing about these people who say that, these inadvertent executions are just the price we have to pay, I really wonder if they'd say that if it was their child who was going to be executed wrongfully. So, I've discussed the errors of the death penalty. Now I'd like to just talk about its infection by racial, economic, and geographic discrimination. I've already discussed the geographic discrimination at the beginning of my presentation, and I've already discussed the economic. But I'd like to talk about the racial discrimination. Now, there's been study after study of this across the United States, okay, in state after state after state. I mean, the evidence is incredibly powerful. And here's what it tells us. Everything else being equal, that is, you control for all factors, how bad the crime was, whether there was eyewitness, the strength of the case, the number of bad facts. Everything else being equal, the same exact crime, you are 4.5 times more likely to get the death penalty if you kill a white person than if you kill a black person. That is indisputable. There's indisputable statistical evidence of that. And the United States Supreme Court has said, we don't care. But whether the American people are willing to say we don't care is another question. There's indisputable evidence of this. The General Accounting Office in the early 90s synthesized all the study and says the evidence is just overwhelming. The death penalty is racially biased. And it's not just in the South. New Jersey had problems, Connecticut's had problems, Philadelphia's had problems, Colorado's had problems, California's had problems. And another thing, while, you know, the evidence as to the race of the defendant is not as powerful, I can tell you this, in study after study, the racial configuration most likely to get the death penalty is a black defendant convicted of killing a white person. It's incredibly powerful. And, you know, the reality is if you do death penalty work, you have to know that. You tell your clients that. And one other aspect of the racial issue that's very interesting, there was this massive study that's actually continuing of capital juries. It really analyzed cases from 14 states, thousands of cases. Well, not that, like 1,500 cases or so. And they interviewed jurors, and they very closely looked at life cases and death cases. And here's what they found. If 6 or more jurors are white males, 78% of the cases resulted in death. This is black on white cases only. If you have a black defendant and a white victim, and you have 6 or more white jurors, 78% of the cases resulted in the death penalty. However, if 3 or more jurors were black males, there is no difference. It's the same as any other racial configuration. But we know that throughout the United States, the Supreme Court has kept reversing cases on this ground, that there is discrimination against African Americans in jury selection, particularly in death penalty cases. As United States Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun said, when he finally said, "I washed my hands of the death penalty," this is a quote, "Race continues to play a major role in determining who shall live and who shall die." Now, the next thing I want to talk about is the extraordinary waste of scarce government resources that capital punishment constitutes. And this, you know, this is an issue that people are paying more attention to given the economic crisis that we're living through. A lot of people think it's cheaper to give someone a death sentence than a life sentence because you don't have to keep them in jail for the rest of your life. But in fact, again, there's been study in California, Maryland, a few other places. There have been studies, careful studies by bipartisan commissions that have shown that a death penalty, an act of judicial killing, an execution, cost on average $2 to $3 million, far more than any prison term, including life without parole. It is far more expensive. There's no doubt that we are wasting millions and millions of dollars in the United States by pursuing the death penalty as opposed to life imprisonment, including life imprisonment without the possibility of release. Now, the question is today, can we afford this anymore? Why are we wasting this money? And I should say, too, that the death penalty is so much more expensive, but really we're getting it on the cheap, too. And the reason we're getting it on the cheap is that state after state refuses to adequately fund lawyers for poor people. Okay? The death penalty, you know what it really is about in many, many cases? Not every case, but it's often just about poor people getting lousy lawyers. Again, you know, you can look throughout the United States and you'll see that. It's just about poor people with lousy lawyers. Now, I'm not saying that everyone who's on death row had a lousy lawyer. I'm not saying that. But that is a, there's a consistent pattern for that. Now, another thing about the death penalty is that it's still, well, in 1972, when the United States Supreme Court halted the death penalty, it said it's arbitrary and capricious. It's like being struck by lightning. But it really wasn't that arbitrary because they really knew what was going on. They knew it was racially biased. That was just a polite way of saying it's racially biased. But, you know, it continues to be arbitrary. It continues to be like being struck by lightning. Only 2% of all murder cases result in a death sentence. And that's true in death penalty states as well. It's a lottery. It makes no sense. You know, you go see the Brian Nichols case in Atlanta, where he shot up the courthouse and killed the judge. He gets life. Then you, and Georgia's got a lot of big death row. And then you go to Washington State, which has people on death row, and Gary Ridgway, who I think, I don't know how many people, was he supposed to have killed 49 people? He got life. It just makes no sense. It's just, it's a crapshoot. And that's not, that's when we're talking about killing someone in our name. Again, another problem with the death penalty is that it doesn't do anything for us. It doesn't protect us. It's a symptom rather than a solution to our to the cycle of violence that we live through. Another thing, and I mentioned this briefly, is that the death penalty is harming survivors. Now, the suffering of a survivor behind suicide is immeasurable. No one can understand it, and I don't purport that I can. But the death penalty does nothing. It doesn't bring them closure. Politicians talk about closure. Now, some victims, survivors do too. But many, many survivors, a growing number of survivors, are saying, you know, don't kill in my, don't kill in our name. You know, I think the way to, one person I heard quoted said, you know, the death penalty is an appalling memorial to my murdered loved one. And it just deepens the culture of violence in society. There was the Supreme Court in a case some years ago said something like, well, we got to get these cases, these death penalty cases, you know, we got to get the executions rolling because the victims, the survivors need it. And there was a survivor who said, how dare the court purport to speak to us, for all of us? That court was not speaking to us. You know, do people care how I feel? Everyone expects that I'm supposed to want this person to be executed. Another victim said, you know, if I wanted him to die, I don't see what difference there would be between him and me. The difference with him, he is a murderer. I'm not a murderer. The other thing I want to talk about, and the final problem, another real problem with the death penalty, in my view, and is that it's just a torturous experience, not only for the survivors, but for the defense, for the guys on death row. You know what it is? It's a deliberate and excruciatingly painful and slow killing of a human being. 10 to 12 years. The defendants in general, most states, you go to death row. You're confined to a cell 23 hours a day by yourself. Okay? You get out an hour. In some states, you're allowed to have group rec with two or three people. In some states, you go by yourself into this cage. And in the Connecticut, where I practiced for 5 years, the Michael Ross case, Michael Ross was allowed to have no physical contact with any human being except for the guards and the lawyers. Not the family members, not other prisoners, no one. Year after year, sitting in your cell. They used to work, they took that away, they didn't want them to work. And more and more judges throughout the world are recognizing that this is just a barbaric way of treating someone. We know that, I'm not denying that these people did terrible things, if they're guilty. But this is no way for a civilized society to be treated. I'm just going to close with, and then I'll take questions if there are any. I read this recent quote from the great Irish poet Seamus Heaney, and he said that hope is not optimism, which expects things to turn out well, but something rooted in the conviction that there is a good worth working for. But I think that for the death penalty, we have both reason for optimism and reason for hope. We can be optimistic because it's clear we are on the road to abolition. The world is on the road to abolition. Country after country, state after state. And I can tell you, even the United States, one thing I should have mentioned was that, you know, in the 1990s, 80% of Americans supported the death penalty. Just ask that question. Today, it's about 64%. So it's still a majority, but it's significantly reduced. More importantly, it used to be that if Americans were said, do you support the death penalty or life imprisonment without the possibility of release, most Americans said the death penalty. Today, the country is evenly split. So if you ask the question, do you favor the death penalty, 64% say yes, approximately. If you ask the question, what do you prefer, the death penalty or life imprisonment without release, the country is split 50-50. And another really significant development that's occurring, in the 1990s in the United States, there were around 300 death sentences being returned every year in the country. The last 3 or 4 years, maybe 5, has seen approximately 120. So it's over a 50% reduction. Prosecutors and juries are simply refusing to impose death sentences at an increasing rate. So we are moving towards abolition. But I also think there's reason for hope. Because the abolition of the death penalty, it seems to me, is definitely a good worth working for. Thank you.